This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling. JT Allen, this is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Nation, welcome to episode number 4 of Letters from Center Stage. I'm your co-host JT, of course, in our PTBN offices in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to dive deep into the outer rim of the nostalgia mothership known as WCW. But of course, before I take that ride, as always, I need to stop in jolly old England, pick up my co-host, that is the chap they call Alan. Alan, how are you today, sir?
As always, phenomenal, but I'm still getting over Kevin Sullivan's face paint and suit combination from the last episode when we talked about Baywatch, and still scarred me that. What was he thinking? He looks ridiculous. But yeah, if anyone's not listening to that, listen to episode 3 where we go in depth and do a deep dive into the Baywatch episode that featured some of the WCW guys.
I cannot wait to test out that look at the beach this summer. I'm totally going for it. I'm going to walk out. I'm going to purchase a piece of property on the beach or next to the beach and walk out with a suit and some face paint and laugh about it, cackle about it.
Well, make sure it's near a boy. Well, that sounds so wrong. But make sure it's near. No, in fact, no, boys' clubs. I'll forget that boys' club comment because it'd come out wrong. So, without further ado, shall we go and get our first question of the week?
Let's do it. Let's dip deep inside the plunder bucket.
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Their plunder bucket. So, hey, Alan and JT, my favorite wrestler of all time was Norman the Lunatic. Mm. What an underrated talent. Can you talk about his run with the company and what he did after that? Love the show. Miss you, Parv. And that's from Dan McGinn. So thank you very much for the question there, Dan. I think that came through on an email. And I'm sure Parv misses us as well.
He's just trying to get Parv to buy him a new car. That's all it is.
Yeah, well, there we go. But yeah, thanks for the question there, Dan. And Norman the Lunatic. So we've covered him before on Letters from Kayfabe. We went through his whole, you know, Bastion Booger kind of run. That whole mess of a mistake where he was portrayed as some sort of eating out of a bin gargoyle in his horrible suit. But we're now going to touch on his run in WCW, NWA, the kind of early years of our kind of coverage that we're covering. We go from about 89 to the end of the end of WCW, which is obviously 2001. So he came in 1989 as Norman the Lunatic, which was a bit of an odd gimmick. Was he an escaped guy from an asylum, a mental asylum, that had a fascination with cuddly toys? Is that probably the best way to describe him?
Yeah, he was supposed to be an escapee because Teddy Long, who brought him in, his manager, carried around a key, which was Long's potential to recommit Norman to the insane asylum if he did not follow his orders. And he carried that teddy bear with him, probably to, I don't know, keep him grounded, I guess, and help keep him calm as needed. But he would eventually break away from Teddy and become a face in the Norman the Lunatic role. I guess he was renamed Norman the Maniac at some point, but Norman the Lunatic, I think, is what everyone really remembers him as. He actually had a pretty decent run there, but I do remember him with Teddy Long in some deep, dark recess of my memories of wrestling. And again, I didn't start watching until 1990. That was WWF. I didn't get into WCW probably till like late 91, but for some reason, I remember him with Teddy Long watching something. So I don't know if my dad was watching or whatever, but I definitely remember Teddy Long carrying around the key and Norman looking like an escaped mental patient. And I will say this, as a kid, it was pretty effective act. Like, he seemed like legitimately crazy and a guy that like was dangerous and Teddy Long had to keep intact.
Yeah, he was, he wasn't a bad worker either. I mean, people, his most famous one is obviously his Bastian Buger, and he wasn't great there at all. He didn't have any standout matches. But he kind of came to prominence as Mackensingh in Stampede, where he had a great series of matches with Owen Hart. He really made Owen Hart look really good. He was a good base for Owen Hart. Mm-hmm. He was a solid promo at the time as well. But he's definitely someone, if you can check out some of his matches, they're not going to be on the playlist, but you can easily put them on YouTube. Mackensingh versus Owen Hart in Stampede, and you'll get a few coming up there. Definitely ones to check out, and you may get a different appreciation for old Norman Lunatic.
Yes.
But he makes his WCW debut at Clash of the Champions 7, Guts and Glory, where he has a quick squash match victory over Mike Justice, who's someone, from memory, doesn't stand out to me at all as someone. I think he was just knocking around as a lower card jobber. I think he was a jobber in WWF as well. He had a couple of WWF job matches, but no one that really stands out to me as a kind of memorable jobber at all. So he went over Mike Justice in 47 seconds. So this is at the time when he was brought in, like you mentioned, with the Teddy Long, portrayed more as a heel than as a face. Would that be fair?
Yeah, so for sure. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, because I think after this, he was on TV on World Championship Wrestling, and he beat Bob Emery, and then did the house show loop where he was going over Steve Casey. He actually beat Scott Hall in 89, which is quite interesting, on the Great American Bash Tour, which was in Raleigh, North Carolina.
So was that just like Hall as just like a face Scott Hall, but pre-Diamond Stud or whatever, when they just probably just signed him? Because if Norman's still a heel, right? So it must have just been breaking Scott Hall in, kind of thing.
Yeah, this was after Scott Hall's AWA runs, and this was before the Diamond Stud. So he was just kind of Scott Hall. I don't know if he had any extra gimmick than that, and I don't think he was featured heavily on TV, if at all, from memory. But yeah, so he beat Scott Hall. He was beating Steve Casey around the loop as well, Boston Gardens, UCI Pavilion. He actually had a TV title match against Sting on the Great American Bash Tour, which he lost. He would have been still, obviously, heel at that point. He was picking up wins against Ranger Ross on the road. He was teaming with the Skyscrapers. They were beating Tommy Rich, Johnny Rich, and Davey Rich, which is... Oh my god! I never realised those three tagged together there. But yeah, we got the Rich Clan got beat by the Skyscrapers, which was the Dan Spivey and Sid Vicious incarnation with Norman.
The Rich Clan. I'm just trying to just to note on the Scott Hall thing real quick. So yeah, he actually went to the NWA in '89 by Jim Ross. They were trying to develop new young stars, and then that's when Brian Pillman and Sid came in as well. He was on pay-per-view The Bash, participating in the King of the Hill Battle Royal, jobbed a lot, and then he left, went to Puerto Rico, did some stuff in Texas, and then came back as Diamond Stud. So this was like his initial run here. It was very brief.
So it was only a short cup of coffee with WCW right at the time. So he went on, and he was then getting beat by the Z-Man, who was probably featured slightly above him in the pecking order at that time in WCW. And I mean, this was getting into the fall time of the year, because his debut, like, as I said, that was getting back there. That was the summer. That was in June. So by the fall time, he was, you know, losing a few matches. But on TV, he was still going over. He'd beaten Ricky Nelson, Rusty Riddle. What a great name for a wrestler. the infamous Lee Scott and Thad Clark on TV from Center Stage in Cobb County Civic Center, which are obviously WCW mainstay arenas. That's why we obviously call the show what we call the show. But around this time, he has his face turn late 89, because he starts a kind of mini feud going into 1990 with the Iron Sheik. What a feud that was. You know, so memorable. So house show matches. Would you be happy to see a Norman the Lunatic Iron Sheik match?
In 1989, no.
No, 1990. No, this was even worse.
Yeah, no, nothing, anything I'm interested in. I'm curious if Rusty Riddle is Matt Riddle's grandfather or something.
Yeah, well, I need to check that after the show. But he does have some kind of TV, big TV and pay-per-view things. I mean, he's involved. He's at Clash of the Champions 10. He beats Kevin Sullivan in a Falls Count Anywhere match, which is something else. I mean, on the playlist, I think I've put the end of that match where you see Kevin Sullivan stumbling out of a toilet. And I don't know if it was it Gordon Soley or was it Bob Caudle?
It was one of them there. It was definitely Soley sitting there, yeah.
Yeah, so because you had... Kevin Sullivan, he stumbled out with a toilet seat around his neck, didn't he?
Yes, he does. And Sully's just standing there. It was a women's room, too. They make it very clear it's the women's room. And he comes stumbling out. And it would not be the last time the WCW match goes into the women's room. But, yeah, he comes stumbling out with the toilet seat broken over his head. And Sully's just standing there, like, staring at them.
Yeah, I mean, he has that match there. So he's feuding with kind of Sullivan and Sullivan's gang of misfits around this time, because he goes on and has the match with he beats Cactus Jack Manson at NWA Wrestle 190, Wild Thing. on TV then. He's teaming with Abdullah against Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan. So this is this Sullivan Slaughterhouse, or is that the name of his TV promo kind of gimmick that he did? Because he had a crew of a band of misfits around this time. Because obviously Kevin Sullivan always surrounded himself with guys like that throughout his career, especially in Florida. He had the Purple Haze and people like that, and it kind of carried on into NWA, WCW around this time. So he's beating guys like Ray Apollo, Cactus Jack on the house show circuit, and he's teaming with the Road Warriors, and this was at Capital Combat. They beat Bam Bam Bigelow, Cactus Jack, and Kevin Sullivan. So, you know, Norman the Lunatic, he's getting one up here a lot of the time on Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan, isn't he? So they're pushing him all through 1990. There's kind of a mid-card babyface. Someone that would appeal to the kids. Someone, and I can see that, how that fits, really. He's kind of simple, kind of a prototype to a Eugene character in certain ways.
He sounded a lot like Eugene. When I watched a couple of the promos from him, his inflection, like, it wouldn't surprise if Eugene had watched some of his stuff when he came up with the gimmick, because the way he talks and the inflection sounded very much like Eugene. Sullivan Slaughterhouse was the name of the stable. So the Varsity Club faded away in late 89. Sullivan hooked up with Cactus, Buzz Sawyer, and himself to form the Slaughterhouse, and then feud with Mike Rotunda. That was one of the earliest ones.
Oh, yeah, when it was Captain Mike, he used to be captain of Varsity Club, and then he decided to be captain of his ship, which is another classic WCW Jim Herd, I think, at the time gimmick. So he does actually go into 1991, does Norman, and he's always pushed because he's beating the Motor City Madman, which is, I'd love to have a discussion about that man. Definitely a WCW favourite of mine, the Motor City Madman. So he's beating him on house shows, on TV. They actually, him and the Juicer, this was early 1991, they got beat by the Freebirds, which, yeah, the Freebirds were getting pushed around that time. I know the Freebirds sucked for a lot of people. Listen to our sister show, not our sister show, one of the other shows on the feed, which is where the big boys play, where they go through all the WCW and NWA shows, the big shows, and they're not well liked by Parv and Chad on those shows. But you can see the team of Norman and the Juicer being kind of a team that, you know, they both appeal to kids, don't they? They're both that kind of demographic. So they work well, you know, it kind of works well as a team, really.
Yeah, and they had a lot of, it was around this time where, like, you know, that Jim Herd era, where they had a lot of these more gimmicky stuff they hadn't really seen in WCW at the time. Like you said, the Juicer and Norman, you know, and Captain Mike, and everyone started to become more and more gimmicky, trying to mimic, I think, obviously, what was going on in WWF. That would obviously change pretty quickly. They'd get away from that in 92, but there is that run right there where they're really, really gimmicked up. And if you watch some of those 91 clashes and pay-per-views, you get a full dose of all of it. Oz, like, just all that stuff. You know, they were rolling it all out. The ding-dongs, all that stuff. That all comes out during this era. So you could tell that they were really trying to go gimmick-heavy during this time. And whether it was to appeal to the kids more, I'm guessing they felt like they were losing that battle and their fan base was aging, which is probably true. I think that was a big part of what they were doing at this point.
Yeah, definitely. So we kind of fit with that. I mean, the sad thing is, with his run in WCW, it kind of just petered out. It ended in 91, really. And what the story goes is, how he got fired was really sad. I think it was Jim Ross who told the story on a podcast. The idea was he hadn't been booked in a while. So he asked someone in the office to go ask Vince McMahon about it. This was how he left WWF.
Okay.
So not WCW. I don't think he was actually booked. I think in WWF, it was just a case of Vince forgot that he was there. And when it was brought to his attention that he was there, he just fired him. So that was a kind of a sad thing. That was actually WWF, not WCW. But I'd imagine, I wouldn't have shocked me if that happened in WCW as well. So he left in January 91. And the next time he kind of shows up anywhere, was Calgary was always trying to do TV, you know, after Stampede. We had the Canadian National Wrestling Alliance. And they did some stuff in Calgary at the Silver Dollar Action Center, some TV. And he got beat by... he got beat by Ron Ritchie when he went back to the Mack and Singh character. And then again, he tags with Ron Ritchie and he gets beat by Bulldog Brown and Les Thornton, who were both about 65 at this point. You know, that would have really not been a good match at all, probably, but it's not a match I don't think we'll ever see, or I'm ever going to track down anyway. And then after that, this is quite interesting. He leaves working in Canada and he goes for a little stint in Mexico. In 1992, doesn't he? So he's wrestling as I believe he's called Aaron Grundy in CMLL, which is he's there for a good from 92. He's there for a good year. he's there for the full calendar year, really, and he's in a lot of these trios matches, you know, against the Brazos, and he's against Brazo de Plato in singles matches, because obviously Aaron Grundy being a big guy, and Brazo de Plato more famously known to people Super Porky. Don't get me wrong, he wasn't as huge as he got in later life, because he was still in his, you know, I think in his early 30s at that point. But, you know, he was a bit more rotund than some of the other two Brazos, which unfortunately one of them passed away this week as we record this, Brazo de Oro. And the Brazos themselves, great trios team, should really be in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, but this isn't the really show to discuss that. So he has that run there as well, and then in 93 he shows up, as we all know, as Bastion Booger. So that's really Norman the Lunatic, Norman the Trucker. I mean, he went from Norman the Lunatic, he changed to Norm the Trucker at some point during this run. I can't pinpoint when that actually was.
Yeah, looks like it's sometime in 90. But then I can't tell if he goes back to being Norman again, if he's just Norman. Like, it's kind of confusing the way Graham has it listed. But I do want to see, there is this match that happened here between Trucker Norm at Center Stage Theater and Keith Hart, which is funny that they brought him in from Stampede to kind of renew that rivalry or that the relationship there. But that's such a random match to happen. It was October 90 in Center Stage. Trucker Norm defeated Keith Hart at 153.
Yeah, I think that may have been a favor or something like that, I can imagine. But yeah, there's a few matches to check out. I think I put on a match versus Brian Pillman on the playlist, mm-hmm. as well, which is, you know, Pillman's always good value to watch. So that's a kind of fun match. But that kind of covers him, really, his kind of career. He was a mid-carder. He put smiles on faces of kids. Got to sound like Vince McMahon. He was good for the role. He fit for purpose, really. I had no problem. And he had a good, you know, 2-year run, more or less, with WCW. So I think, you know, they got plenty of mileage out of him, and I think he did okay. I don't think there's really much more really to say about him. But if people want to check him out, I would really look at his 86-88 run in Stampede, as Mack and Singh. That's where he's done his best work.
Oh, for sure. That's where his most legendary stuff comes in from, and the feud with Owen. And obviously, you know, he had the relationship with Pillman from Stampede too, so I think that carries over to that match they had in WCW. But a guy filled out the card. You know, he was obviously fine enough. I liked him as the heel, Norman the Lunatic, better. But I think he's a guy that's necessary wrestling, especially at a time like that in the early 90s. He obviously stood out. He's a memorable character, so.
Yeah, definitely. I think someone we probably won't touch on again, but there, that hopefully answers the question there. So, shall we move on to the second question of the show?
Let's do it. I'm ready to get paid.
Oh, yeah. So, everyone knows about the Lanny Poffo Gorgeous George story. What are some other examples of performers on six-figure contracts who, over a period of years, only appeared sporadically? And that's from Adam in New Jersey. So, Lanny Poffo, it's kind of written about that, you know, he was in WCW for years and years, which is true. He was brought in 95, and he was never used particularly. I think that was mainly, I would say, as a favor to his brother.
Right.
Didn't you say Randy Savage?
For sure. I mean, when you say never used, never used. Like, he never appeared once anywhere for WCW.
But there's an urban myth, though, with him, that he was dressed as Wildcat Willie. He was made to do the Wildcat Willie at one set of tapings, but, you know, that's never been proven, and he's not going to really admit to that. It's a little bit embarrassing if a guy like that was doing that. But I think, looking at money-wise, people were thinking he was getting these kind of six-figure salaries. And from what I can see, he was getting about $75,000 per annum, you know, at the start. Maybe the deal was renegotiated, but he wasn't on a huge salary initially. But the whole idea with him later on, I mean, Adam from New Jersey asked a question, just touch on the whole Gorgeous George story. But if people don't know what the plan was, the Gorgeous George name was purchased from a guy called Robert Kellum, who was an independent worker. He'd bought the Gorgeous George rights from the family. He was working, I think, as Gorgeous George 3 on the kind of North Carolina Independence in about 95 time. Mm-hmm. So there was a deal struck up at some point where Randy Savage bought the gimmick. And the idea was that Lanny Poffo was going to portray Gorgeous George, to the point where he even dyed his hair blonde. He'd watched countless hours of Gorgeous George tapes preparing for the role. But the problem was WCW never actually called him. The call never came. Eric Bischoff had about a million people on the roster at this point, so he's not going to remember frisbee-throwing Lanny Poffo. You know, he's not major in his plans, unless Randy went to bat for him, or even if he did Eric even listen? Or was he too busy to care? You don't know. But in the end, the role actually went to Stephanie Bellows, who was Randy Savage's girlfriend, real-life girlfriend at the time, and she played the Gorgeous Joe moniker instead of Lanny. And I don't know if that brought some heat for between the two or what happened there, but that was kind of a bit bizarre to me, because if Lanny was going to portray the role, surely Savage wouldn't allow his girlfriend to do it. unless he's doesn't care about. I don't know, but that's right. What happened anyway. There, so that was really the most famous guy that was never used. And he literally was under contract for up until 99, I think. Looking at kind of the records that I've dug up, I think Chris Harrington, Mookie Garner did some good kind of WCW salary work, and I think David Bixenspan dug up a lot of that information a few years ago as well. So it's definitely out there if you guys want to check it out. But that was kind of the first guy that WCW didn't use. But there was a few more examples of this. And there's another thing that I wanted to touch on about before this. It was how wasteful they were. With money as well. I think I'm just trying to find where my notes are. I don't know if you've got it in front of you. Who they paid a famous dancer. This was it. In 1998, they paid $100,000 on dance lessons for Alex Wright and Tokyo Magnum as they flew in Baristakhanov, who must have been a famous Russian dancer. So they flew him in on four occasions, and his fee was $25,000 per session. So for instead what? Of just getting one of the Nitro girls to show them how to dance...
or watch a video. That would be an easier way. I mean, come on. No one cares anyway if they know how to dance.
So they dropped $100,000 on some Russian dude to come and teach Alex Wright and Tokyo Magnum to do a dance. I don't remember this paying off. Were they doing any pirouettes in the ring? Were they standing on the tiptoes after this? Were they doing any ballet moves? No, all I remember
they were
doing
the same dance Alex Wright had done for 4 years already or whatever. It was the same thing. And by the way, Gorgeous George, that might have to be its own. Hopefully someone writes it about that. She was kind of the earliest of, we talked about, last week we talked about how Tom Zenk was the earliest shoot interview guy. Gorgeous George was the initial kind of hachi-machi female wrestling sex tape woman. Because if you remember the infamous video that she made for Randy Savage that leaked out there eventually, I think broke in many, many adolescents into the wonderful world of internet porn, I think, during that time frame. But anyway, just I always think of that when I think of Gorgeous George. Probably not what Lanny Poffo intended when he dyed his hair the first time, but that's what it ended up being.
Yeah, I think it's a shame anyway, because I think, 95, 96, Lanny Poffo would have been quite fun on WCW TV.
Not as fun as Gorgeous George, the female.
But yeah, so there's some other examples. We had Kevin Watchlaws. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I think it's Wachholz.
Wachholz, there we go. I'm rubbish at pronunciation sometimes. So that is, as everyone knows, Nails, former Letters from Kayfabe, Favorite Nails. He worked in WCW. He had two kind of runs. He came in as the prisoner. I think, was it 93, he had that little feud with Sting? Was it a Slamboree?
Yeah, he came in for the one show, and he had the same exact outfit. Like, they didn't even try and hide it at all. He looked identical, the orange jumpsuit with the same numbers on the back, I believe. And yeah, he was just called the prisoner. He was a mystery opponent for Sting, and I don't think he does anything else beyond that.
No, I mean, the only other thing he does, he was brought in 1998, 17th of April, to a house show match, and he beat fellow Minnesota native Barry Darso in the opener. So they brought him in 98. I have no idea why. I think they just wanted to sign everybody. Right. And then he was literally paid to do nothing. So he earned, in quotations, $144,000 in 98 and $100,000 in 99. And his contract was terminated on May the 28th of that year.
He's so useless, too. Like, what were they going to do with him? I mean, was he coming in for another feud with friggin' Ray Traylor at that point? Because he was still there, I think, in early 98. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like just a name that no one cared about. No one was clamoring for Nails' return in any way. He had long out, past his expiration many, many years ago. This stuff like this has to be a favor. It has to be favors. Like, he must have been buddy-buddy with someone, and they said, he's hard on hard times. It had to be some reason. Why would you just bring back frickin', Nails in 1998?
To stick it to Vince. Maybe to stick
so
it
what?
To
Vince.
Vince
is just laughing that they're blowing the money on him. He doesn't give a shit.
Well, it's the whole kind of the old, he accused Vince of sexually assaulting him in 92, which was, there's witnesses there say that didn't happen. To be honest, that didn't happen. Let's be honest about that one. So yeah, he was a whack job, complete whack job. And then we didn't see him at all in wrestling after that. All I remember from him, and I mentioned this before, is they had to fake his voice for Nails on WWF TV because his actual real talking voice didn't match his body. You know when you hear someone speaking, you can't help laughing.
Yes.
Because they don't sound like they look. Yeah, he was one of those guys.
Like Jack Campbell, yeah.
Yeah. definitely someone that was paid to do literally nothing. And there was another guy I wanted to touch on, was a guy called Swole. Do you remember Swole?
Oh, I remember Swole very, very well.
This is your kind of era, more your era, late 90s than myself. I mean, my viewing, I'd really thrown in the towel, but, I've gone back over the years and looked at some of, this stuff. But what were your memories of Swole?
That he sucked. He was, of course, part of the No Limit Soldiers that were brought in to feud with the West Texas Rednecks. And, you know, inexplicably, WCW tried to make the No Limit Soldiers the faces in the Southern promotion where, you know, legendary wrestler Barry Windham and legendary wrestler Kurt Hennig were leading a country music group up against the, you know, African-American No Limit Soldiers. Like, I don't get if I guess they thought they were national enough to not be seen, like not have it be as racist as it ended up being. I don't know. Maybe this assumed, like, okay, we're kind of a national promotion now. These guys are popular. You know, Master P is a pretty well-known musician, or, you know, rapper. So maybe they just figured it, the name was enough to make them faces, but it backfired big time because they just got booed left and right, and the West Texas Rednecks basically became faces out of it. And the Soldiers, it all started with Master P coming in. He, you know, he's on TV. He's a big wrestling fan. Swole was one of his bodyguards brought in, and then he turns wrestler, kind of like Test would do when he was Motley Crue's, I guess it was the year before, Motley Crue's bodyguard and became part of the WWF. But so Swole would join up with the rest of the No Limit Soldiers. One of my favorite No Limit Soldiers segments of all time was on Nitro when they had a birthday party for Silk the Shocker. I don't know if you remember that. That might be another one we have to explore. And it ends up with a cake getting thrown in the West Texas Rednecks' faces. But the No Limit Soldiers' whole thing was very, very weird. It was, I don't even know. I don't. It's like the intentions were right because Master P was pretty hot. He's into wrestling. You know, they're kind of on, you know, finger on the pulse. And it just, in WCW fashion, just goes ass backwards. Like, they just completely botched the whole thing. You know, of course, the rallying cry they had was a hootie hoo. That was a famous No Limit Soldier, Master P, you know, catchphrase. And so, yes, that led into the whole stable being built and feuding with the West Texas Rednecks. But Swole was pretty useless. I mean, it was a big part, I think, to obviously put him in there as an unestablished rookie, kind of get him over a little bit, pair him up with what would eventually be BA, known as was Brad Armstrong, where he'd just get his ass kicked the whole match and Swole would come in and score the pin. And it just never really worked. Nothing ever really connected. Even with Mysterio and Conan being brought into the group to help get them over, that didn't work either. The whole thing was just a mess. And I feel bad because I think the Rednecks were pretty much punished for getting over at their behest as they got moved out of the feud. And pretty much and run out of there. So the whole thing was kind of weird. They just abruptly ended that. And I think it was a punishment for them showing up the No Limit Soldiers. But the whole thing was kind of stupid.
Yeah, but then it was called Randy Thornton, this guy called Swole. And just getting back to Master P, another example of WCW, knowing he's pretty big in the US, literally never heard of him. I don't know, obviously I've heard of him now and at the time, but right. When this came out and I was still reading about WCW in the magazine, I'd still catch the odd thing. I had no clue who Master P was. He was a very US-centric star, so another one that resonated with an international audience. But Swole was a guy who'd worked elsewhere before this. People assumed he was a Master P's actual bodyguard, which he may have been, I don't know. But he'd actually worked in wrestling before. He'd worked some AWA shows just before the promotion died in early 91. And he actually wrestled in New Japan with a boxer gimmick. And I think he wrestled Shinji Hashimoto, on one occasion as well. That was his kind of foray into wrestling before this. But he was signed to a deal in WCW that paid $350,000 for the first year, in addition to a $50,000 signing bonus. He's shown as having been paid $30,890 in payroll in 2000 as well. And he only wrestled six matches in 2 months during the summer of 99 before disappearing.
And he was terrible, too. He was terrible. I mean, he's... You could tell he just didn't have much to him, and the way they kept protecting him and having Armstrong. And by the way, repackaging Brad Armstrong, who's great, but putting him as this No Limit, so, you know, in the fatigues and the BA nickname, just it didn't help. Like, you know, we're trying to build this, in their mind, cool stable, and you're saddling him with Brad Armstrong. It just made no sense.
But, I mean, it's just ridiculous. You've got guys like this who'd not done much in wrestling, and they're getting $350,000 per annum. You know, it's crazy. These are prime examples why WCW, you know, were hemorrhaging money left, right, and center. Their roster was far too big. People on far too big contracts. And the guys that were on these contracts, 99% of them weren't, you know, negligible, you know, drawing, you know, anything at all for WCW. So it was a complete waste of time, complete waste of money. And Swole's just a guy, a footnote in WCW. For a footnote to be paid $350,000, it's crazy.
And if you remember, 4x4 was part of the group as well. He's still around on the indie circuit, or at least as of recently he was. But he was pretty bad as well. He was part of the group, and he bounced around till the promotion ended. He was be part of Harlem Heat 2000 as a bodyguard, wanted by Cassius, and then Cash, and just he was another awful guy. The whole stable was a mess. You know, they tried. They had good intentions. Master P was paid $200,000 per appearance for his participation whenever he was on. So, again, more money. But, I mean, I can say P was pretty big at this point. Like 99, 2000, like that was his prime run. And he was actually, you know, I think he became eventually an agent or something. And he's been pretty successful since. As far as like representing, I think it was like athletes and others. So he, and he's actually a really good basketball player too, if I remember correctly, but, he ended up being a pretty successful guy in business. But at the time he was, this was probably around his peak era.
But yeah, to pay Swole that much money for six matches, all but one of which were regular TV tapings, you know, it's just crazy. But that's WCW for you. So there's plenty more examples of this, and then we're going to probably revisit this in question again, and, you know, other examples over the years of just blatant WCW wasting money, be it for mini movies. You know, we can talk about those fantastic mini movies that they did in 93, to other things that over the years that they've done that was just a complete waste of money. The Kiss stuff, you know, the whole Kiss concert and how much they were paying Kiss in, I think it was in Nitro, was it in 99? They had Kiss, so they had the Kiss demon thing as well.
It was right toward the end of Bischoff's era.
I mean, 99 was my weakest area of knowledge. I mean, I came back, I don't know why, I was buying some of the tapes in 2000, some stuff. So I remember like Harlem Heat 2000 when they brought in Ahmed Johnson, who was like £600 at this point. You know, just ridiculous stuff. We were fighting over the name T with Booker T. Oh, yeah. So there's, but yeah, 99. So this, because most vague memories would have been 1999. So I didn't really remember much of Swole apart from when I went back to him. But yeah, what a complete waste of money. So that's the end of Swole and this question for this week, so thank you very much for the question. Shall I jump into the car?
Yeah, hop in the car, because it is time to head back in time for this week's 1-800-CLICK Road Report with Alan, taking us this week in history, WCW history.
The United Center, but tomorrow night we're going to be at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. We've already sent our good friend Lee Marshall there, and he reports in from Milwaukee on the road with 1-800-COLLECT. Lee, are you cold?
Tony, I am cold, but the only thing keeping me warm here is the Cheeseheads. I mean, the fans here haven't been this excited since the Bucks won the coin toss and got Lou Alcindor as their first pick.
So, yeah, this week it was 5-12-94 at a WCW Worldwide taping in Orlando, Florida. WCW World Heavyweight Champion Ric Flair defeated WCW World TV Champion Lord Steven Regal in a marquee Queensbury Rules match. So this is something, you know, was getting rave reviews in 94. They had a series of matches, Ric Flair and Lord Steven Regal. So it was the marquee Queensbury Rules Cup was five-minute rounds, one per week on TV. And it was contesting under the marquee of Queensbury Rules, which is basically the British style of wrestling. So it was round rules. And it was very, very interesting to see Flair in a round environment, you know, and you've got some judges at ringside. You've got Sergeant Craig Pittman's there at ringside, Jesse Ventura. He was buried in the United States Marine Corps in one of the episodes. And it's really good. I mean, this whole series, these seven matches that went throughout, you know, the summer of 94, they aired on TV. It was one of, you know, my favorite kind of 1994 memories before Hogan came in and, you know, ruined things a little bit. And it's definitely that the really awesome, highly recommended matches. So the things you can check out, the whole series is on YouTube to check out. But yeah, I think for me, William Regal in 94, sorry, Lord Steven Regal at the time in 1994 was awesome until he got injured. He was, he had those matches with Flair. He had the really underrated match with Arn Anderson at Super Bowl IV. Mm-hmm. He had the series with Larry Zbysko, which happened on this day in 94, a few days ago. He'd lost the TV title to Larry Zbysko there, and he fired Sir William at the time, who was Bill Dundee, who was acting as his butler, who was on the booking committee around this time. And he had that solid stuff with Johnny B. Badd as well and Brian Pillman. So, yeah, Regal was really good value in 94 until that injury. Definitely check Regal out. But have you got any memories at all of this series of matches, JT?
Very faintly, and it's a weird time, too, because it's in that odd stretch where Flair was a face and kind of, you know, gaining momentum. He had turned, and where he had still been face, and he was really, you know, coming off that great two-match series with Ricky. I think it was a two or three. I think it was two matches with Ricky Steamboat, right? Saturday night and then Spring Stampede.
No, I think there may have been three, actually. But, yeah, they had that series of matches, and there was one that was a double pin off a chicken wing or something. And then it was over the title anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Spring Stampede is the double pin. I think the pay-per-view one actually is. And then they fight again on Saturday night. But, yeah, I mean, they had a great feud going, and then it gets all abruptly ended because they have to hastily turn Flair heel to have the match with Hogan, which, again, made good business sense, but the timing is so abrupt. It's like he's in the middle of all this stuff going on. He's really getting over his face. He feels like, okay, legendary Ric Flair is being treated that way. He had the book. He was booking at this point. Has this good series with Steven Regal, elevating him. And then, boom, he's just back to being, you know, evil Ric Flair with friggin' Sensational Sherry, or Sensuous Sherry, randomly brought in as his manager. So it is an odd twist. But this is the kind of cool stuff that is in that little hidden era from January to June of 94, with so much good stuff going on in WCW. And I will never fault them for bringing in Hulk Hogan. Like, I think from a business perspective, it made a ton of sense. But from just a hardcore fan perspective that didn't care about their books and or their money, this was one of the better stretches in WCW history from a quality perspective. When Ric Flair was booking, and, you know, it was very work rate focused, and they would do, you know, the brawling wasn't hokey. It was hard-hitting brawling, stuff like, you know, with Cactus Jack and Max Payne and Kevin Sullivan and the Nasties. Like, all that stuff was hard-hitting. You had great, brutal matches between the Boss and Vader. So, I mean, there was a lot of really fun stuff happening during this time. And shit like this, too, on TV. Saturday Night was really well-regarded in 94. So, it was a time where they were really finding their way, very similar to what WWF was doing, finding their way with Bret Hart and the new generation away from Hulk Hogan. And WCW seemed to be doing the same, and then brought Hogan in, and everything just pivots immediately. But this, to me, is one of those examples of the different, unique stuff that they had cooking here in the middle of 94.
Yeah, a big fan of the early 94 era myself. I mean, the interesting thing that happened in 94 as well was the Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton having to work the ECW when the ECW show in 94, if you remember.
Yes.
It was all over the When's World Collide, using the pay-per-view name, if memory serves me right.
Yeah, I believe so. Yep. So they were trying to make up to ECW for using that. And then, so basically to make up for it, they let them borrow a couple of guys.
Oh, it was something like that, but I think, actually, my timeline might be wrong. There was a reason for it, because the When World Collide pay-per-view wasn't until November 94.
They definitely had done something to breach. Yeah, I'll have to see if we can look it up. There was some reason that they breached, and then as a result, they were allowed to use Eaton and Anderson.
Yeah, so that was basically the whole talking of on this day was the Marquee Queensby taping match. So it's definitely something you guys should check out, because they're a fun series of matches, and you get to see the round style and Flair working it, and that's interesting on its own. So, yeah, definitely something I recommend to check out. So shall we now get the long-form question asked and answered? Because this is peak WCW wackiness, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. And right before that, though, Alan, I will say the world, you were right with When Worlds Collide, but that's what I think led to Austin coming there, it looks like, because he tried to get Austin before, and they wouldn't let him go because they were part of the Hollywood Blondes. And then that happened, and ECW had already had that show. So when lawsuits threatened, WCW backed off and then let them have Austin. It looks like maybe.
Are you sure it was Austin?
Yeah.
I don't know, because I thought Austin got released by Bischoff in 95, and he went to WCW. Something maybe.
Well, he got hurt. All right, so he was actually part of the agreement, and then he got hurt, okay. So he never came. And then he got released, and then he came anyway.
Okay, right. So getting to the long-form question then, this is probably one of the most infamous matches in WCW history for the wrong reasons. So why was the uncensored 1996 Doomsday match such a mess? No one seems to know the rules. So I haven't got who wrote that question. It's not actually on my document. Have you got that in front of you there, who asked that question? I may have to thank them later and dig it out.
I don't have it here in front of me, Alan.
Oh, I'm sorry who asked that question. I'll have to dig
that. Actually. It's at Betty Owens from our buddy Ben Owens. So there you go.
There we go. Sorry about that, Ben. Thank you very much for the question, and thank you for supporting the show. So, I'll call you Parv then, JT.
I feel really bad. It's tough when you come off a long relationship and you're with your new, you know, new...
My rebound.
JT. I like to think I'm more than a rebound, Alan. But yes, that I know it's tough. It's going to take a while to get those memories out of your mind. And by the way, because I don't want to have people calling us out, the... Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton thing with ECW was a payoff for them helping promote WCW Slamboree in Philadelphia.
Okay, there we go. I was getting muddled up as well. We didn't want to confuse things. Our kayfabe memories not being as good as...
You want to get an RCS out of nowhere, you know?
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, going back, so the question there was Uncensored 96 Doomsday match, such a mess. And my God, words literally can't describe how bad this is, JT. It's...
awful.
Go on. Describe the cage structure for us.
So it's a triple cage, a Doomsday cage. There's the one cage on the floor, then there's a second cage, and there's a top cage, and... basically, what they had to do was, it was Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage had to fight their way through all the cages against this army that Kevin Sullivan and Ric Flair, fresh off the beach, had put together, the Alliance to End Hulkamania, gathered this group of, consisting for this match, Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Ming, the Barbarian, Lex Luger, Taskmaster, Z-Gangsta, who was, of course, the former Zeus, the Ultimate Solution. And, of course, they were along with Woman, Miss Elizabeth, and Jimmy Hart. Originally, Brian Pillman was supposed to be in that group as well. We'll touch on that in a minute. It was and Chris Benoit as well. And the whole thing was just a disaster. So the three cages are stacked on top, and they're supposed to basically work their way down until the final showdown in the ring. And they have to battle through, and they have, like, certain time frames where the cage doors open that they can get out. And they have to fend off who they could. And it's basically a whole bunch of handicap matches for Hogan and Savage all the way through. And it was a disaster.
It was more than a disaster. It wasn't a cage that was the same ring that was used for the rest of the Uncensored card, though, was it? Was it a different cage to the side of the building?
Right, yes. Yeah, it wasn't the actual main ring, right.
Yeah, so I think from a crowd point of view, you know, you're at the other, you know, it's at one corner. It wouldn't have had great sight lines for a lot of the fans. I think this would have been, you know, awful from a live perspective to follow and watch, because you had a load of guys in different stages of a cage or different areas of a cage, all waiting for Hogan and Savage to come and have a fight with them. So all Hogan and Savage did is go from one person to the next, beat them up a bit, don't pin them or anything, and then just go to the next person. And it's just, it's ludicrous. It's two guys versus, does it end up being eight? Is there eight guys in this match versus Hogan and Savage?
Yeah, it's eight. And it's not just any eight. It's not like it's eight scrubs. You know, it's not the eight guys from, what did we talk about last week, the Underdog Tournament. I mean, stars. Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Lex Luger. You know, I mean, like, these are legit guys that they're battling. Ming, who had been pushed as a you know, really roughhouse barbarian. Like, these are actual real wrestlers that they're mowing through. It goes almost a half hour, 25 minutes of just so boring. And this is like peak Hulk Hogan is jerking off over the whole WCW roster. I mean, this is like him basically saying, I'm going to beat everyone and anyone you put in my way. For him and Savage to take on eight and defeat eight guys across three different cages was just like, it just made no sense. Like, and I don't blame, you know, Brian Pillman, basically, he was supposed to be in it. And this was during his whole work shoot thing where he had quit. And they showed up on Nitro, and they said he was going to be part of the match, and he just fucking doesn't show up. Because I don't think he knew. Like, he didn't want to get buried on TV on pay-per-view by Hogan as part of a 2-on-10 match or whatever it's supposed to be. So, I mean, he just no-shows it or whatever, and, like, whatever. So, you know, he knew he had free agency coming up where he was trying to work his way out of his contract and all that. So he didn't want that this stink on him at all. So, smart by there. Do you know why Benoit didn't end up being in it? I know he was supposed to as well.
Oh, I don't think it was ever explained.
Yeah,
I think it was just... Just didn't show up. This is the whole thing. I mean, why would Ric Flair agree to this? You know, and Arn Anderson, you know, has Ric Flair not got any power at this point, or is he obsessed to be associated with Hogan shows or in Hogan matches? I don't know. I mean, this is a whole mess for Flair at this point in, you know, in 96, early 96, isn't it really? It's just a mess. So he had them at the start. So the Mega Powers started against Flair and Arn Anderson, who were also present at the conclusion. And then what happened right at the end? So he went around beating up everyone, as we said. And then who comes out with frying pans? The one and only Ed Leslie, the Booty Man.
The Booty Man.
Yeah, and so they're just punching, kicking, and hitting people there with frying pans. For, you know, as you said, it's nearly half an hour. And then it all comes to, thankfully, a conclusion when Lex Luger, he accidentally, you know, decks Ric Flair. I just don't get it.
Well, Luger was the most interesting guy in this match because he was in the middle of the whole thing with Sting, if you remember, where they were kind of being friends, but he was still working with the, you know, the Dungeon of Doom and the Alliance. And he was kind of this awesome tweener role. And it was kind of right after this is when he settled in purely as a face. But from the fall till here, he was one of the most interesting guys they had on the roster. And him and Sting were supposed to fight the Road Warriors earlier in the night to defend their tag titles in a street fight. Luger had to be in this match instead, so Booker T stepped in. And that goes a half hour, too. And that's not as fun as it sounds like it would have been. So again, not much on this card, but yeah, Luger was probably the most interesting gimmick wise here. And to pile on top of the rest of this mess, the Ultimate Solution, who of course will go on to be a Bane in the Batman movies or whatever.
Yeah, was it Jeep Sweeson? Was that his name?
Yeah, Jeep Sweeson, yeah. But of course,
huge roided up guy.
His original name in WCW was The Final Solution, which of course raised a lot of eyebrows, and immediately was renamed The Ultimate Solution, and then ultimately made his way out of the promotion.
It's just awful. This is bottom of the barrel creative, isn't it, at this point? Something that doesn't make any sense. You're burying eight guys at the expense of what? To prolong an angle, did Luger mean it or not mean it? It's not worth it. Lex Luger, it was a fun angle, and he was doing the stuff where he'd come out, and when Sting was looking, he would be smiling and clapping hands with the fans, and then as soon as Sting turned his back, Luger would be like, I don't want to touch you and talk to you. That was really good, but it was, had so many plot holes in it when Sting would just, clearly wouldn't he just watch back the matches?
Right, no, never. He only watched the match, never the intros. But it, at the very least, it was interesting. It was something different, and Luger was getting it over. It was fun stuff. This was not fun. This was a train wreck, and you just it made no sense. I mean, I get at the end of the day they were just trying to blow off the whole. You know, Hogan had been feuding with Sullivan in the Dungeon of Doom forever. I mean, since late '94 when they were the Triangle of Terror or the Three Faces of Fear, whatever the hell they were. And you know that started when it was Shark, or I guess it was Avalanche originally, Butcher, Avalanche, and the Taskmaster, and then that originally, you know, eventually changed over, and then the Dungeon of Doom showed up. So I mean, Hogan's been battling these guys forever, and Giant came out of all this, so he had, you know, he was burgeoning at this point too.
JT, I just popped into my head. You said it better than me when we were talking the other week about this. What's your favorite Hogan line when he's dealing with the Dungeon of Doom?
It's not hot. I mean, that's the classic one, right? Where he goes into the dungeon and he touches the water. I don't know if it's supposed to be hot or what the hell it was, but he just proclaims that it's not hot. So
instead of it's cold or, you know.
It's hot. You know, just lie. Like, yeah. Why do you have to be honest about it? I think it's, I don't know. Just, I don't get it.
No, very bizarre. Yeah, the whole Dungeon of Doom thing. And then, obviously, Kevin Sullivan's still knocking around on screen, feuding with Hogan at the Baywatch that aired in 96 later on in the year, didn't he? So
yeah.
He's all over with Hogan for a long, long time.
Oh, he is tied obviously to Hogan. And he was doing a lot of the booking. And, I mean, he was a smart guy, right? I mean, who are you going to tie your ship to? Okay, you know, he basically told Hogan, hey, buddy, you can beat me and my stable, but we're going to program for a year. You know, like, he perfectly played off of Hogan's ego by saying, you'll be the top dog. I'm going to feed you guy after guy to kick their shit out of. And he tied himself to the stable. So he was constantly in the main event scene for like a year and a half.
I'm positive now Kevin Sullivan's been stoned for the last 40 years. you know, and I, you know, he's known to be a bit of a cannabis fan. And I think he would have maybe, you know, smoked one too many joints before booking this. And this is what he came up with because, yeah, it's not great.
I'm surprised
than not great.
I'm surprised the Sullivan-Benoit theorists, conspiracy theorists, haven't tied this match and him keeping him out of this match started it all. Until eventually.
Oh, now you've said it. Now we're going to get, you know, some questions on this one. Though,
right.
Where you've said that, JT.
But
yeah, I don't know
there.
I don't know what Meltzer rated this match. I can't remember. Did he go the whole minus five stars on it?
He should have. If he didn't, I don't know. But yeah, he. God, I hope so. I hope so. It's a bad match. I mean, it really.
You can watch the kind of 3 minutes of this match that are on YouTube from the WWE account. It's on the playlist. I don't think anyone's either cared enough to upload this match because it's that bad, or it keeps getting taken down. But there's not much else out there about this match unless you know obviously watched on the WWE network.
He went -3 stars, which I'll never understand on the star level. Like, what's the difference between -3 and -5? Like, how could this have been any possibly any worse to not get to the -5? Like, what makes him stop at 3 on a match like this? And by the way, this card also featured a dud and a -1-star match, so there you go.
Oh, it's one of the worst cards of all time. Really, this and the 95 uncensored shows are just absolute pits. But I'm going to actually tweet. I'm going to tweet Dave, and I'm going to, when this show drops that day, I'm going to tweet him and say, so Dave, why was this -3 and not -3.25?
I want to know the difference.
Yeah. Oh, no, he'll end up blocking me and taking my Hall of Fame vote off me. So I maybe don't want to poke the bear by doing that. But yeah, it's definitely a -3. Why -3? Well, that's just Meltzer for you. But yeah, I don't really want to talk about that match any more than that because it's horrible.
Awful.
It's absolutely horrible. So that hopefully answers that question there. And I'm not really want to revisit that match anytime soon. But yeah, that's classic what this show's all about, though, to be fair, isn't it, JT? That type of thing.
Oh, for sure. We love it. I mean, last week we talked about that Baywatch episode, which was tremendous. And this week, touching on this, it's always something. So if you're out there, you know, listening and you want to get in touch with us, these are the types of things we're looking to talk about. Just the dreck of WCW. And there's some good stuff in WCW, too. We'll filter in. But there's some really, really bad stuff. When it was bad, it was bad. And that's the stuff we want to look at. And, you know, we know we'll be touching more probably in that 99 era, too, because there was a whole bunch of bad to come up at the end days. But if you do want to submit a question, Alan, where should they be doing it?
Okay, if you want to get us a question, there's two ways to do it. The first way is to tweet myself at Alan_Cheapshot or tweet JT at place2 with the number 2, B Nation. Ask the question on there. Obviously restricted to 140 characters, so it might be wiser to actually send us an electronic mail to letters from centerstage@gmail.com and send us a question there. I'll reply to you, say thank you very much. You can give us some feedback of the show, what you like, what you don't like. All feedback's more than welcome. So they're the best ways to actually get hold of us and follow us and all that kind of cool stuff. So I've had a blast going through this show, so on this episode, as every other episode. And as you touched on the last episode, we should have a guest coming up in a future episode, shouldn't we? A former WCW wrestler.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect fit for a show like this. He was there for a while. He had some interesting gimmicks, and he's expressed interest. So we're hoping we'll have him on board in a few weeks here. And, you know, Alan, looking back to really tie into the WCW legacy, I feel like instead of a Gmail, we should have opened a CompuServe account or maybe a Prodigy account. Like, those are more the WCW wheelhouses, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I think they were linked to CompuServe when WWF was linked to AOL, weren't they? At the time, you had the kind of CompuServe. And weren't they the email addresses that they didn't get actual email addresses? It was just a ridiculous array of alphanumeric combinations, you know, about 20 characters long. And then that was your email address. But yeah, I didn't really have CompuServe. I had the AOL chat. That was something that was really popular in 96 with lots of pictures, risque pictures of Sonny, kept a 14-year-old young Alan interested in the internet.
Those are the best.
The good days. But yeah, I think that would wrap up the show. So do you want to just do some of the old Place to Be Nation plugs there, JT?
Facebook.com/Place to Be Nation. Follow us there on social media. You can get involved in our question of the day each and every day. And also just follow along when we have new articles and podcasts posted as well. And of course, download and subscribe to all of our feeds on iTunes, Place to Be Nation Wrestling, Place to Be Nation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. Shop with us online, placemination.com/Amazon. We have free ebooks. If you go to placemation.com, myself and my teammate, Scott Criscola, my PIC, have reviewed WWF pay-per-views, Saturday Night's Main Events, Raws. They're all on there, and they're free, absolutely free ebooks. We also have an index page at placemination.com, and it indexes every single piece we've ever published, both written and audio. So if you go to the index button at the top of placemination, it's all chronological. So if you're new to the site, new to the show, and you want to look back at some of the stuff we've done, it's all right there for you. So when I go to wrap up, Alan, it's been a great time here on the Mothership. As always, we'll be back next Friday with episode 5, Getting Your Questions Today. And until then, everyone take care. Talk to you soon.
Adios.
It's not hot.
Ah! It's not hot!
Is it spread?
Yes.
Niggas, four to go, my hair hoot hoot, it's time to ride, and nuts fly, let nothing go. If you bought your paper, then scream. If you don't fuck with them haters, then scream. If you about big things, then scream. If you about having things, then scream.
Whoa, hold on, daddy, watch my feet. I know you getting riding and everything. Kia, bring that beat back.